Douglas peeped their hand, and Douglas took a principal stand against the American Colonization Society based on the fact that we had earned our right for citizenship before we were born. We had earned it. Our mothers and fathers had earned it, and that we had a stake in this country, and we had arrived ahead of other immigrant groups, including that bunch of degenerates on the Mayflower.
This colored term, here we start, and you mentioned something, I think, this afternoon that's a very important aspect for many people who listen and maybe who even came to our tribute last week for the Black Press. It's amazing when you go back in time and see the level of consciousness mm-hmm. that we were operating from the further back you go.
Actually, the 19th century was our greatest century outside of Africa. We had more and better leaders, straighter on more subjects than we've ever had before or since. The 19th century for African people all over the world was the great century. Look at the Caribbeans, those massive Caribbean revolts, the climax of the Maroon revolts. Jamaica revolted longer and harder than Haiti and did not become independent. Why did Haiti become independent in its series of revolts? Principally because you have to look at the oppressor. Sometimes you have to study the oppressor to understand the oppressed. England could release caliber soldiers to put down Jamaica. France hung up with that stupid fool Napoleon, couldn't release soldiers to put down Haiti. And when finally Napoleon could release the soldiers, the Africans had stiffened their backs and their defenses to the point where they could slowly stop them, and they did.
If there was one way, I guess, for us to describe how African people should be viewing this July 4th, today here in this hemisphere, North America, what would it be? How would you describe this?
I think I have a touch of the dictator in me someplace. And as much I know it's never going to go anywhere, it's all right to say it. I would dictate that every black person in this country read Frederick Douglass's 4th of July speech. He was clear. Say, what is it to me? What is it to us? What are you celebrating? What are we celebrating when you're practically putting us back into slavery? And I think independence, it has a general meaning to the rest of America, but we have to understand that we were not brought to America to be given democracy. And there's a whole lot of whites who wasn't brought to America to be given democracy. We haven't studied white servitude in America. I think Lerone Bennett, in a book called The Shaping of Black America, has the best chapter on white servitude that's ever been written so far. And he shows that many of the whites from Ireland and poor countries of Europe came over, and the captain paid their way, and they had to work their way out of indenture, the same as the blacks. The early blacks were indentures other than chattel slave. We have to study the first 100 years after 1619, and we'll find this out. And I think in Lerone Bennett's, in the same book, in the second chapter called Third Generation, he shows what happened to the initial Africans, the old 20 or more, and what happened to those families, because some of those families became landowners, and one, Anthony Johnson, became a slave owner. Carter Woodson has written a whole book on black heads of families in the pre-emancipation period, and there's also a book on black slave masters. I mean, I'm not happy about them.
Right.
I'm not happy about the fact. I'm not happy about the fact they didn't quite understand. See, now, chattel slavery prevailed in this country until England got tired of buying new slaves every 7 years or 10 years. And they began to propagate the concept that a slave is a slave the rest of his life. England began to change the whole concept of indentured servitude to chattel slavery, but they did not do this for the whites. Many of the whites saw no difference in their lot, inasmuch as they came over on filthy boats, and they were literally auctioned off. And we have forgotten how white people, how badly some white people were treated in this country. And in the Westward Movement, many of there was mostly men, and they just recruited defenseless, and women with no means of support in Europe, and auctioned them off to be the wives of these white, I'm talking about white and white now, of these white men. Sometimes if you understand what happened to whites, you will understand more what happened to you. And so there was an auction out in the West, and all of the girls had been taken, that, you know, bought or taken, except one kind of bony, not too handsome white girl. And the auctioneer appealed to the manhood of the buyers. And because he said, this wench is crying. Nobody's even made a single bid on her. And some toothless critter, you know, spoke up and said, I'll pay a dollar for the wench. And the auctioneer says, give me a dollar, take the wench. I'm talking about how white people treat white people.
I understand.
And you have to understand something else. Why and how this nation was designed in the first place. It was designed, if you look at the founding fathers, all this is proven, this nation was designed as a haven for free white Protestant males, middle class and up, those who agreed with the prevailing political status quo and who owned property. The white woman got the vote in the United States day before yesterday, 1921. And when all her trickery and all her shouting and all her protests couldn't get her the vote, she put down her lead card. She said, in a country where no white women can vote, some black men can vote. Then they gave her the vote.
1190 is WLIB. My guest this afternoon, Professor John Henry Clark, educator, historian, and author. We're going to be taking your telephone calls for Dr. Clark this afternoon at 692-9542. And the nationwide toll-free number, 1-800-332-1023. Our conversation this afternoon will be on world African history.
Accountable. The social organization needs to be more accountable. Everything that touches our life should be at least in part an instrument of our liberation and the maintenance of our freedom, or it should be discarded. We're people who have to travel with light luggage these days, and we can't afford all this excess junk that's attached to our lives.
Dr. Clark, there's some people who see it, some will say a trivial pursuit or not necessarily significant, whether the identification that we select for ourselves as African-American as opposed to black American. Do you have thoughts about that?
See, I'm against black American because, see, blackness tell you how you look, but it don't tell you who you are. I said before that the proper name of a people must relate to land, history, and culture. And any time you address an ethnic group and fail to relate them to land, history, and culture, you have called them out of their name. It is significant. See, black is a color identification. There's no black land, there's no Blackville, there's no black Ola. You got to identify with a piece of land. When you say African, you're identifying a land mass, 12 million square miles. You're identifying African people stretched throughout the world, maybe 300 million African people live outside. In the Western world alone, you might have easily over 200 million African people. You got Brazil that has the largest African population outside of Africa. And the problem in Brazil is they've convinced the Brazilian African that he has no problem. And that is his problem. And he has to look around and say, if I have no problem, and if there's no discrimination in Brazil, why is it I don't even see a chief clerk in a hotel that's black? Why isn't the head of the garbage collector is not even black. Everything of a managerial nature is run by whites or the brown Brazilian. And when are we going to deal with the illusions of freedom as against freedom itself? I think that maybe the African American is the most politically alert, and he's 10,000 years behind where he's supposed to be. He's the most political alert Africans outside of African, and it is not because he is a black American. It is because the nature of oppression has forced him to be in order to survive.
1190 WLIB. There is more to come this afternoon inside of the GBE. My guest, Professor John Henry Clark, educator, historian, and author. Our topic this afternoon, world African history. Yep.
For the people who would condemn in slavery time their brothers and sisters for being ignorant, listen to the story the drums tell. They say, you black men should love those brothers and sisters even in death. Because that valiant struggle for life made you what you are today. So keep on growing for them, in mind, in body, and in soul.
Don't call me nigger, white. Don't call me white. Call me nigger, white. Don't call me white.
It's Monday, July 4th, 1988, and you're inside of the GBE at 1190, Radio in the Key of Life, WLIB. My guest this afternoon, Professor John Henry Clark, educator, historian, and author, taking on a journey this afternoon through world African history, yesteryear, this year, and today. We're also taking your telephone calls at 692-9542 and 1-800-332-1023. Dr. Clark, with so much attention focused on the July 4th, 1776 aspect, one of the points that we made a bit earlier, and you certainly, I think, have addressed it as well, is the irony of us looking at this day in some format of celebration when one of the points that I mentioned a bit earlier was the fact that although the Declaration of Independence was adopted, it's noted that a section denouncing the slave trade was actually deleted from that same Declaration of Independence. And when we at least begin to get our hands on at least some of that information, it tells us a little, but it really doesn't tell us a lot about what was happening globally in terms of those Africans who were being dispersed in other hemispheres, South America and so forth. Could you address that in that year, 1776? What was happening?
1776, now we have almost the climax of the importation of the slave trade. The traffic at sea is slowing down now because nearly everybody who can afford one has got one. And besides that, slave breeding farms, you can breed them like you breed chickens or horses.
What do you mean by that now, slave breeding farms?
There were farms in the West Indies and in the United States, and I think the best article that I have read on slave breeding in the United States was by Professor Milford Fierce. He's at Brooklyn, Afro-American Studies Department at Brooklyn right now, and he furnished a lot of documents. America tries to deny that there were slave breeding farms, and many Caribbean people, black as well as whites, deny that there were slave breeding farms in the Caribbean. See, now with a ready supply, human supply, you don't need as many being brought from Africa.
Okay.
But in the meantime, the condition of slavery has already forced several major revolts. I mean, these are revolts before the American Revolution of African people, not in this country, but outside. The Barbies revolt in Guyana, the revolt at Palmares in Brazil, the revolt at Salvador, Bahia.
Mm-hmm.
Palmares was an African state in Brazil that lasted 110 years.
Right.
And what killed it? Integration. They integrated a bunch of whites, and these whites sneaked out and told the Portuguese how to get into that. They had a fortress city with protection, with guards on the high tower, you know, looking out for anything to approach. But the Portuguese that the Africans had brought in and given complete citizenship and democracy betrayed them.
This is under the leadership of Zumbi during this period?
This is the Zumbi period. Mm-hmm. This is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Although the revolt started before Zumbi.
Before him, yeah.
And did not end with Zumbi.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't end. Palmares had to be beaten to his knees. Well, Bahia was forced to surrender.
Is it true that in the context of the difficulty that they had with Palmares is that they burned it to the ground? Is that
accurate? Yeah, they destroyed every semblance of what the state used to be. And I've been to that vicinity. The blacks in that vicinity still have a spirit that you won't find at Bahia.
Mm.
The same part of, we're talking about Brazil and
yes.
Brazil now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the blacks in the Palmares part has a spirit of a heritage of revolt.
Mm.
While they at Bahia, while they have a heritage of revolt, they did ultimately surrender.
Mm.
At Palmares, they did not surrender. We need to look at the major revolts of blacks in the whole of the Western world. And we need to look at the Caribbeans. We need to look at it better than most Caribbeans are willing to look at it today.
What do you mean by that?
Because the slave masters in the Caribbeans in the South America bought in large lots and kept the lots together. So therefore, in the Caribbeans, they could maintain an African culture continuity, which was the basis of their revolt. Now, I've said this, and I've been misunderstood every time I said it. Nearly every slave revolt in the Caribbean was instigated by a house servant. Nearly every slave revolt in the United States was betrayed by a house servant.
Hmm.
And it didn't prove that one was braver than the other. In the United States, they bought in small lots and broke up the lots often. So mama goes one way, papa goes another way. They buy 10 slaves early in the week, they might sell 5 before the end of the week. So when you're breaking up the culture pattern, you're breaking the loyalty system and the culture continuity. Now, in Haiti, when Christophe went to Leclerc, who had then imprisoned and sent out of the country to Toussaint Louverture, but Christophe was streetwise for his day. He had been a stable boy at the French Inn. He had been a head waiter. He'd been a mercenary soldier in the American Revolution.
Mm.
And so when Toussaint Louverture went to see Leclerc, this is Napoleon's cousin, you know, went to see Leclerc, Toussaint Louverture went all by himself in a coachman. And he got imprisoned and sent to France by orders of Napoleon. When Christophe went, he took 3,000 soldiers, surrounded the Catholic, marched the whole company right into the living room and said, "Monsieur Leclerc, what do you want?" Couldn't touch him.
Yeah.
You can't touch him. No matter what you want, he's got his stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
Then he gave an order to Leclerc's servant in an African language. And the order, the servant was a captain in the Haitian army, and a spy.
Ooh.
And the order was burn Cape Haitian, burn the city down. And so when he retreated, he just joined the other soldiers, took his contingent and joined the other soldiers, burning down the city. The French retreated to the hills, and he put a wall of fire between the hills and the ammunition dumps, the French ammunition dumped along the coast. And this is where those French just died with malaria and everything, all that pretty red uniforms and tunics. It just went down the drain. Both Toussaint Dessalines and Christophe were military geniuses. I think Dessalines probably was the greatest one. He came straight from the fields, and he is the, when you go to Haiti and ask who is the true rebel, the true hero of the Haitian Revolution, they respect Toussaint. They respect Christophe. But to the common people, Dessalines, the tiger from the hills, because he came down with the lashes still on his, but the scars still on his back, you know, and he laid the basis for the Haiti still to come.
There is an area globally, as we move across the globe and look at the revolts that we have engaged in, there's an area that we don't hear much about. And I think that more brothers and sisters, probably as a result of the propaganda that is coming out of Australia in terms of the PR campaigns and so forth, begin to get a bit curious if they see a movie like Crocodile Dundee or something, and you happen to see some brothers and sisters kind of make their way across the screen here or there in a scene. Mm-hmm. There's clearly something going on in Australia with us as a people.
Well, see, Australia and those adjacent islands, especially the island of where they killed most of the people, the Tasmanians, were mostly black with admixture of Polynesia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot of islands mostly black. Those islands were settled by British prisoners and debtors and ladies of the evening or the night, and people with no visible means of support.
Australia was Siberia for the Europeans. Exactly. Yeah.
And those prisons, this is the 200-year anniversary. This is what they've been celebrating only a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came there as prisoners. And when the British got frightened about the blacks at Tasmania...
Why did they get frightened?
Because these blacks seem to have a very good sense of humor. And that almost... And the British got frightened because they would poke fun at the British. They would poke fun at the British hats. And, you know, first the British got incensed about it. Because here these blacks were actually laughing at these fools. But when the British got frightened, they destroyed everything, man, woman, and child. And see, there were Irish prisoners in the lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the Irish prisoners was given so much off of their sentence, depending on how many Tasmanians they killed. And so the Irish had to bring two matching ears of a Tasmanian.
Wait a minute, Dr. Clark. They had to bring two matching ears of the people they killed, the Tasmanians.
Look, this is on a book. This whole lot's in a book. It's in the British public office. All the records are there. And I have a book right in my home called The Last of the Tasmanians. Go to the library and get it. You know, big thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's another book called Trouble in Trouble in Paradise, dealing with how the British took over the Pacific. And Captain Cook, the main explorer, put 10 syphilitic British soldiers down on one island and came back 10 years later. They had destroyed one-third of that island. No, the Pacific Holocaust of African people hadn't been told, because it included African, Polynesians, and others. But there was a large African mixture in Australia and in Tasmania and in the island called the Solomons. Well, they're still there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in New Guinea and what, we've forgotten the Dutch input. Those people who wear wooden shoes and are supposed to be so antiseptically clean, they even named a cleanser after them, Dutch cleanser, one of the most vicious murderers ever. Slave traders. They had Guyana before the famous Babis revolt, by forcing the Africans in, and mainly led by a man named Kofi, who had seen his own, who was a house servant, and had seen his own wife beaten to death, and then he began to have a fit of consciousness. because he did not lift a hand to help her. And after that, he started the revolt. He deliberately married an escaped woman slave. When they wanted her bag, he said, come and get her. And he had it ready. And all the documents he signed at the bottom was the word, never again to be a slave.
Never again
to be a slave. Now, the first recorded slave revolt in the Caribbean really started in Cuba around 1527. I've done a long, if you forgive the modesty, I've done a long article called The Role of African Culture Continuity in Slave Revolts in the Americas and in the Caribbean Islands.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done another one, African Cultural Response to Slavery and Oppression in the Americas. See, in the years when the McCarthy period was riding all radicals out of town on a rail and people were crying about oppression, I took a thankless job at NBC. It was a high-sounding job. I was nothing but a high-class porter, night supervisor of maintenance.
Night supervisor of maintenance.
For the first time, I got by $4.80 an hour. When you think right now, sometimes I get $3,000 for a lecture, less than an hour.
Exactly, right?
I guess different wavelengths that you travel
absolutely
on at different times in history.
For sure, exactly.
You just try to keep you calm about all of it.
Yeah, it's true.
But we need to look at this in the Caribbean Islands. We need to look at Brazil. We need to look at the fact that with two Brazils,
mm-hmm.
or two slave trades, two Portuguese. See, because after the Treaty of Tordesillas, when the Portuguese were awarded Brazil, the Portuguese had so much land they couldn't manage it. And so all they needed white people. And so they began to scrape the barrel in Portugal. And so the Portuguese who were brought to Brazil looked around, and someone said that all of this is for the mother country. And one said, the mother country never done much for me. All this is mine. So a fight then started. That was to pull Brazil away from Portugal.
Mm-hmm, I see.
And finally, that was a Portuguese slave trade supplying Brazil, and one supplying the markets at Lisbon and other. This is why the fierceness of the Portuguese slave trade from the 16th, almost right into the 18th century, and which leads us into the fact that on the east coast of Africa, the Portuguese started in the south and moved up, but the Arabs were starting in the north and moving down. But we haven't dealt with the Arab slave trade, mm-hmm. and I guess it has to be the subject of another lecture, because many of the brothers who are Muslims and who adopt these Arab-sounding names don't know that the Arabs were the only Muslims in the world who use Islam as an excuse, as a rationale, for the slave trade.
Mm. There was something that you mentioned, and before we go to the break, I want us to maybe just slip this in, because for those who may just be joining us, you've been taking us on this global tour, and many people do not see the area of Asia and India in the context of African history. And you mentioned some things which I think it might be a good idea for us just to maybe sort of recant a bit, because there is clearly a presence that still exists today, as you were mentioning.
Joseph Harris, Professor Joseph Harris of Howard University, has written a little book called The African Presence in Asia. It deals mainly with the African presence in India, but it is still a good book, and eventually he's going to expand it to include these other areas. Many Africans were sent to Asia or taken to Asia as mercenary soldiers to fight in the wars of the Maharajas, some who didn't seem to trust local armies because some of them were oppressors too.
Mm.
Though they were Indian,
mm-hmm.
they were oppressors of other Indians. See, but before that, the Iranians, after the Iranian occupation of India, We have to study Iran. We have to study Western Asia called the Middle East, because Africa's first big trouble came from that area over 1,000 years before the Africans saw the first European. And but many Africans were women as mercenary soldiers, and men, because the soldier generally travels without a woman, and he never abstained from that biological necessity. And so now you see the African woman marrying the African man, marrying the local woman, creating a separate, you know, Indian group.
The untouchables, as you mentioned earlier.
Well, it's not accidentally that the untouchables in India are the blackest of the Indians. It's not accidental.
Yes, it is no historical accident, right, as you say. 1190 is WLIB. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and we'll take more of your telephone calls leading towards 3. Let me remind you, if you just joined us, my guest is Professor John Henry Clark. He'll be with us until 4 o'clock, so we have lots of time to get to your telephone calls and more to deal with in terms of our travel through world African history, yesteryear, this year, and especially today. And it's a beautiful Monday, of course, July 4th, 1988, and lots of history still in the air with Professor John Henry Clark, our guest, educator, historian, and author, taking us through world African history, yesteryear, this year, and today. The Declaration of Independence, of course, was adopted today. We remind you, though, that there was a section denouncing the slave trade that was deleted. Keep that in mind as you barbecue and celebrate this particular day in history.
You may do all this, and the idea that he was born to be free will survive it all. It is a lie to his hope of immortality. It is the ethereal part of his nature which oppression cannot reach. It is a torch lit up in his soul by the hand of the deity and never meant to be extinguished by the hand of man. And that's all I have to say. My name is Saeed.
All right, thank you, my brother.
I'm familiar with the book and the document, and it also calls to our attention the fact that there were many whites who risked life and limb and reputation to make principal statements against the idea of slavery. And we also forget that the Constitution and the Declaration was toned down, and the anti-slavery aspect was left out with the assistance of Benjamin Franklin.
Mm-hmm. 25 minutes after the hour, 3 o'clock, I'm Gary Bird. To that caller, thank you for being with us. We've been mentioning that deleted passage throughout the course of the afternoon, so I appreciate that caller calling up and sharing it with us. WLIB, go right ahead, please. You're in the air.
Good afternoon. Dr. Clark, I would like to know if you could give me the name of a book that would have an overall view of slavery as it took place in the Caribbean.
Eric Williams' Capitalism and Slavery, and another book called The Caribbeans from Columbus to Castro. Another book, The Sociology of Slavery, by a brilliant Jamaican sociologist, Orlando Patterson, who is also a recent book called Slavery and Social Death.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you very much for your call, 1190 WLIB. I'm Gary Burr. Thank you for joining us. You're in the air with Professor John Henry Clark. Go right ahead, please.
Okay, Gary, I would like to get a tape of this when it's over here. Could I pick that up at jail station?
Okay, we aren't normally in the habit, of course, of ultimately just handing out the tapes, but what you can do is just get me a letter, you know, just basically outlining the fact that you heard the program and you'd like to get a copy of it.
And another thing about what you're talking about, my perception of it, it's good and it's a conversation. But Ford's black people's Ford's now, just like here in New York, I'm here listening that about black history. But where I'm from, Alabama and other southern states, that some of the same things you talk about, we don't get that. Now, I'm not saying it's not there, but I'm saying a radio station like WLIB, Ford has given us the, I would say, the information based on black people. We're not, it's not there. And just like the doctors talking about the different black slave traders, I mean, not slave traders, but how they revolted and all that against slavery.
Yes.
Now, in my mind, you say from 50 to 75 years of looking at TV, in my mind, I can't see that. All I see is the tight Negro that Tarzan, I grew up with Tarzan, the type Negro I grew up with, the slave, being a slave. Even now, as your 40s, your 50s, 60s, when it comes to the black man in the army, in the World War I, II, Korean War, also Vietnam, all I see is the white man. If it's not the white American, it's the British. If it's not the British, it's the German.
Okay, to the call, I think I begin to get the gist of the comment. Dr. Clark, what about those brothers and sisters who, as this brother is indicating, don't wind up getting the kind of information that's available through your lectures or through a broadcast like this, and who really are inundated with really images that ultimately don't give them anything to really believe in or anything that really is going to make them feel proud of themselves? How do we go about reaching those brothers and sisters with information that, to some extent, is almost unbelievable today?
Well, we, with the information, travel over this country. And incidentally, I'm from the backwoods of Alabama myself. And I started off as a Baptist Sunday school teacher. And I distrust the images in the Bible. And I don't believe that God's book left out an entire people.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I began to raise some principal questions about it. I think what we have to do is to make our schools more accountable to us, our lodges, and our churches. Because this is a delicate matter, but I don't know a black minister, never met a black minister who is a great Bible scholar.
Mm.
Generally, he interprets the Bible without knowing that the Bible is basically Jewish folklore. And I didn't say that there wasn't some truth in it, but I'm saying that it was more folklore than truth, because Dr. Ben and I and a whole lot of other people have actually gone to the actual scenes and seen the original manuscripts as against the ones that they copied from, and that will really blow your mind. I think what we need to do is to have a mass educational program on all possible levels. Of course, it was left with me. I'd break most of the TV. That's the dictator in me acting up again, you know, until people really learn something about themselves. And, I think we have forgotten that image controls the mind, and sometimes image tells the mind what to think. And there wasn't enough soldiers in all Europe to gain influence over the large area of the world where Europeans control. The Europeans had to not only colonize history, but colonize information about history. And the most disastrous of all of their colonization is that they colonized the image of God.
Mm.
And they presented blackness as something derogatory and whiteness as something of purification. We have to change these images around.
1190 is WLIB, and it happened, of course, in a history and within a people who greeted those particular invaders in peace and certainly attempted to welcome them to the territories. Smiling faces at 1190 WLIB. I'm Gary Bird. 10 degrees. But it was a different kind of heat. It was nice heat. I mean, you could enjoy it, actually. And I was standing there drinking some juice, and I saw a group of Indians who were just standing kind of on the corner, talking their language and so forth. And I remember that in my mind, it sort of occurred to me, I said, it's interesting, same kind of animations and movements of the hands and so forth that we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, one of the brothers came over to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said something in the language, I guess assuming that I was from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to explain to him, well, I'm not from here and so forth. And so ultimately, I think I got out USA, America, something to this extent. And he says, America, America. So he goes over to one of his brothers, who is jet black, who comes out of the crowd and walks over to me and points to his skin and my skin and says, me, Africa, you, Africa, Africa, not India. Africa. And I remember that I stood there and I said to myself, I said, right, so you come this far to find out that the brothers here actually know their origins. They know where they are from and they know that it's not India.
Well, I found jet black Africans in the United Arab Emirates who were Arab dress, Arab language, jet black. Some object to being referred to as African, and some make a special point of letting you know that they are African.
Exactly, yeah.
And
yeah.
I remember meeting one who objected about 10 o'clock, and he says, I'm Arabo, Arabo. He kept moving away from me as though he was offended. And about 2 o'clock after a meeting, when they announced that all of the conferees can have two telephone calls and send two telex, free of charge, any place in the world. The brother was in charge of the communication. He comes, hey, brother, come here. He looked, and I came and said, that wasn't for you. I said, uh-oh, here it comes. He said, brother, my name is Abdul. You can send as many telex as you want to or call anybody in the world as long as you want to, so long as you see Abdul.
I love it. I love it. I love it. I love
it. Take care of you, brother.
There we go. There we go. The spirit's still alive, certainly in some, for sure.
And then he wasn't as black as the one that I saw that in the morning was jet black.
Interesting.
This one was just moderate brown.
Got it. And the one in jet black in total rejection at that point.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There we go. 1190 WLIV. I'm Gary Bird. Thank you for joining us. I did a song some years ago. It's called Every Brother Ain't a Brother. I'm sure many of you remember that one. Come right ahead, please. You're in the air.
Mr. Bird, good afternoon. May I speak to Mr. Clark, please?
You're in the air with him. Go right ahead, please.
It's an honor, Mr. Clark.
Thank you.
I think you're a great black African historian. I want to know, when they outlaw slavery in this country, why did they not reunite black African people with their families that they were stolen from on the continent of Africa?
Oh, they didn't do that any place. Our greatest problem after so-called emancipation, and I use the word so-called because emancipation was a fake in this country, was a fake in the Caribbean too. Our main problem was to find our fragments of our families within the United States, more so in the United States, because we knew when certain members were sold, and sometimes we could remember what state they went to.
Right.
My great-grandmother's husband was sold to a slave breeding farm in Virginia, and he spent 3 years trying to locate him. Now, people have no vested interest in the unification of African people, least of all the African family. In fact, a war has been declared against the African family. That war is heating up and is more fierce now than it had been in former times. There's certain things we have to do ourselves, like freedom. Freedom is something you take with your own hands. You don't leave it to anyone else, and you secure it with your own hands. And yet, in spite of opposition, we did come together. We did build institutions. The same thing in the Caribbean islands, the same thing in South America, but more so in this country, because we were barred from other people's institutions more in this country than from others. In the Caribbean, you had the pseudo Church of England, you had the semblance of English institutions. But in the United States, sometimes we were without any institutions at all, and we had to build them from scratch, which calls for a different kind of arrangement and institution in the United States than in other places, principally because we inherited the worst of the slave masters of the new world. Very often blacks argue about my slave master is better than your slave master. I enter another side of the argument. I maintain I had the worst one, and that settled that, and I don't even yield on that point.
And this afternoon, what we celebrate, certainly in that context, is not simply independence, but the freedom to be independent. At 1190 WIB, my guest, Professor John Henry Clark, I'm Gary Bird. This is The Experience.
This is what I call...
A bit more amplification before we get to our final telephone callers. And that is that there was a point where we, in seeking integration, really ultimately misinterpreted what that was about. And that misinterpretation resulted in disintegration for us. Mm-hmm. How do we subsequently today begin moving from that whiter shade of pale, so to speak, into an appreciation of our Afrocentricity?
We focus on our community, and we look at other ethnic communities, and we notice that nearly everything in that community is controlled by the ethnic group that lives in that community. I remember when I came to Harlem, there wasn't one boarded up house, and we have to really open up the houses, make them livable, and make our, then we have to not only run grocery stores, but run them well.
Mm-hmm.
We have to engage in mass buying so that we can lower the prices. If one grocery store can't buy a given price, 10 can go together and buy a whole freight car load. Then they can afford to lower the prices because they got low prices, so they can pass some of it on to the other. We have to become entrepreneurs again, mm-hmm. on every possible level.
It's a Garvey philosophy, really.
Yes, it's a Garvey philosophy. And also organizing the basic crafts in the community so we'll know what the skills are.
Mm-hmm.
When you want a plumber, you know where to get a plumber.
Mm-hmm.
Then people take pride in internal services. Take pride in doing something. A black person should take pride in doing something well for another black person.
And somehow I hear echoes of Booker T. Washington, certainly, yeah. In that for sure.
Educationally, I'm a great believer in Booker T. Washington, and I'm not one who condemns him forever for his weak political stand, because I can go to others with a strong political stand. And that don't hold me back.
Take the strengths and obviously go past the weakness.
Du Bois had a good political stand. So I can take Du Bois for politics, Booker T. Washington for education, and Garvey for international African redemption, and Elijah Muhammad for the rebuilding of the state spiritually and the reclamation of the soul along with the state.
1190 WIB, our final telephone calls for Dr. John Henry Clark. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, greetings, Professor Clark.
Thank you.
I have been listening to the discussion all afternoon, and some of the questions I wanted to ask have been somewhat answered, but there are two which sort of synthesizes some of the issues being discussed, and I would appreciate your response. I describe myself as an African born in the West Indies and living in America. And my first question is, how do we go about building an image of oneness, that is, of Africans living in this hemisphere? And my second question, just to let me just write it off and then I'll just hang up. My second question is, I would like to preface that by saying that I have been reading Introduction to African Civilizations by John G. Jackson, in which you wrote the introduction. And do you know of any current movement afoot to institutionalize this kind of history in our pre-college school? And if there aren't any, what would be your suggestion for disseminating this type of information in our community? I'll just hang up and listen.
Thank you for your call.
No, there is an attempt to institutionalize it. The Association of Black Studies being one, a new organization, comparatively new, the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization being still another, the weekly lectures at First World, it's now closed for the summer, but we have lectures all the year round. Beginning in the fall, we'll be back again at 145th Street and Convent Avenue. There are many efforts now, more than ever, to curricularize and to make this basic education digestible to people on all kinds of levels. The Caribbean Cultural Center is doing a new curricula for elementary and high school. So there are different levels all over the country. I have proposed, because in Brooklyn, there are some schools that have 90% Caribbean students, that there should be a specific Caribbean curricula. And this will not rule out or hinder any other curricula. It's not to replace the Afro-American curricula, but to supplement the African-American curricula. Now, there's some movement along this line right now. Bo Banfield, who did curriculas on Harlem and curriculas on African studies, is also working with the Caribbean Cultural Center and developing new curricula. And Adelaide Sanford is working with the center and working with other groups trying to get people on a lay level, on a community level, to begin to develop and present to the state and the city the kind of curricula they want their children to be taught by.
Dr. Clark, I guess in our last few moments, as I mentioned before, I was very pleased to have you here on this day. It is a holiday, and there are many people who are at home. Perhaps in your final comments, could you maybe address how African people should attempt to relate to their children these days that we move through, like Independence Day, bicentennial celebrations, and the like? How should they really be approaching this, as opposed to perhaps getting caught up and victimized by the hoopla?
Well, I think they should first explain what the holiday means to others, then explain what it should mean to us, and how we relate to it, and the parts of it we do not relate to, because it really wasn't about us that they're talking about. I mean, it wasn't about our independence that they were talking about. And when they said liberty and justice for all, unfortunately, we were not a part of that all. They should be very honest in explaining our role in this country and the fact that we were not brought to this country to be given democracy and citizenship. We were brought to labor. And when machines made much of that labor obsolete, they had us here, and no one asking us to come home or making any preparations for us to come home. This is what was so fascinating about the Garvey movement. He said, not only let's go home, but let's get our own ships and go home.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Clark.
Thank you very much.
A real pleasure. Our guest this afternoon for two full hours, Professor John Henry Clark, educator, historian, and author, taking us on this July 4th afternoon through world African history yesteryear, this year, and today. We'll close our broadcast for this segment, and we'll be moving towards our next segment with Phil Valentine, and we'll come into that next segment with some declarations of independence. That'll